Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to have some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. For some time now, we have been studying the web of debt, which is essentially the shocking truth about our money system and how we can break free from it. Over the last several months, I've been looking at how our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been, in fact, privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing us of the value of our money. The web of debt really is a thesis that unravels the deception and presents a crystal clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are all heading. But it also explores a workable alternative, one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. What we're looking at is to find financial security, our own and our nation's and the world's, and that's what we have been dedicating this show to over the last several months in a series exploring the book, The Web of Debt. The Web of Debt is a phenomenal work written by Ellen Hodgson Brown. And I have to say at the beginning that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles related to debt. I highly recommend the book, The Web of Debt, and her website by the same name. And you can also review all of the shows in this series at the archives, www.kruufm.com, under Life and Debt, specifically Life and Debt Web. In the last show, we ended with the March on Washington by the farmers and the industrial workers in the late 1800s. It was led by Jacob Coxey, bringing some 500 people to Washington, marching down Pennsylvania Avenue and inciting a threat that was perceived as so great that 1,500 U.S. soldiers were stationed to resist them. Coxey attempted to deliver a speech on the Capitol steps, but was prevented by the police. He wound up spending 20 days in jail for trespassing on the grass and for displaying a prohibited banner, which was actually a 3-inch by 2-inch lapel pin. His prepared speech was later entered into the congressional record by his supporters. It was very eloquent and moving, revealing the extremity and the despair of a people who had become progressively poorer as the bankers became progressively richer. And for those of you who are perhaps new to the show, this is exactly the theme that we're trying to impress here. The middle and the lower class workers, America's grassroots, are suffering at the hands of the forces that control the monetary system. who in themselves are becoming extremely rich through this process. Coxie had proposed two bills, one primarily to help the farmers and the other to help urban laborers. Under his Good Roads Bill, $500 million would be issued in legal tender or greenbacks to construct the roads particularly needed in rural America. For city dwellers, Coxie proposed a non-interest-bearing bonds bill. It would authorize state and local governments to issue non-interest-bearing bonds that would be used to borrow legal tender notes from the federal treasury. The monies raised by these transactions would be used for public projects such as building libraries, schools, utility plants, and marketplaces. Coxie was proposing something quite new and revolutionary. The government would determine the projects it wanted to carry out, then issue the money to pay for them. The country did not need to be limited by the money it already had, money based on gold the bankers controlled. Money was simply a receipt for labor and materials, which the government could and should issue itself. If the labor and the materials were available and people wanted the work done, they could all get together and trade using paper receipts of their own design. It was a manifestation of the theosophical tenet that you could achieve your dreams simply by realizing them, by making them real. You could realize the abundance you already had just by bringing its potential into manifestation. As a footnote, Coxie was an adherent to theosophical tenets. When Coxie's army, however, failed to move Congress, other industrial armies were inspired to take up the cause. There were over 40 in all. Some 1,200 protesters managed to overcome the resistance of the railroad companies, federal marshals, the U.S. Army, and judicial injunctions to arrive in Washington in 1894. That's one example. Another is a group called Hogan's Army began its march in Montana, too far to walk to the Capitol, so the protesters commandeered a train. When the U.S. Marshal and his men attempted to stop them, a gun battle resulted in several injuries and one death. The U.S. Army finally seized the train. Hogan's heroes were arrested, and Hogan spent 6 months in jail. But what we see here is a response of the people, which continued over the next century. Progressively larger street protests were built on the precedent Coxie's army had established. In 1913, women suffragists sponsored a national march on Washington that had federal support. In 1932, approximately 20,000 starving, unemployed World War I veterans and their families marched for the bonus bill drafted by Congressman Wright Patman. The bill sought to give veterans the present value of their bonuses, which had been issued in 1924, but were not to be paid until 1945. When their demands were turned down by President Hoover, the bonus army camped out in shanty towns called Hoovervilles across the Potomac. The camps did not disband until Hoover sent in troops led by his brightest and best, Douglas MacArthur, Dwight Eisenhower, and George Patton. The veterans were routed and their camps set ablaze, killing 3 and injuring about 1,000. And a final example, in April of 2004, in the largest ever protest march recorded up to that date, more than 1 million people filled the Capitol petitioning for women's rights. So we see that the grassroots response can be quite striking and in many cases effective. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, let's look at popularizing the money question. So we saw that the Greenback Party failed to achieve monetary reform, so many of its members joined the Populist Party. The Populists felt that they, rather than the older political parties, represented the true American principles of the Founding Fathers. And one fundamental principle they felt had been lost was that creating the national currency was the sole prerogative of the government. The populists also favored retrieving for the Commonwealth certain public assets that had been usurped by private corporate cartels, including the banks, railroads, telephone and telegraph, and the public lands that had been given away to private railroad and other corporate monopolies. The populist movement of the 1890s represented the very last serious challenge to the bankers' monopoly over the right to create the nation's money. In 1895, popular interest in the money question was aroused by a book called Coins Financial School, which quickly sold a million copies. Its author, Chicago journalist William Hope Harvey, expressed the issues in a way that common people could understand. He maintained that the attempt to restrict the coinage of silver was a conspiracy designed to enrich the London-controlled Eastern financiers at the expense of farmers and debtors. He called England a power that can dictate the money of the world and thereby create world misery. The Act of 73, called the Crime of 73, the act limiting the free coinage of silver, took away the silver money of the people and replaced it with gold of the British bankers. Harvey observed that the United States was then paying England $200 million in gold annually just in interest on its bonds, and that the devaluation of silver as against gold had caused Americans to lose the equivalent of $400 million in property to meet this interest burden. Coins Financial School set the stage for William Jennings Bryan's Cross of Gold speech, which met with a receptive audience, and Harvey became an important economic advisor to Bryan in his bid for the presidency. In 1896, populist supporters and civil rights dominated the Democratic Convention. All they needed, said one reporter, was a Moses. Bryan appeared to fill the bill, but William McKinley, his Republican opponent, had the support of, no surprise, big business, including a $250,000 contribution from Rockefeller's Standard Oil, which, of course, then was an enormous sum of money. The election was close, but McKinley won, and he won again in 1900. Although McKinley had the support of big money, he was also a protectionist who favored high tariffs to keep foreign marauders out. He accepted the pro-British Teddy Roosevelt as the vice president over the vigorous objection of Marcus Hanna, the power behind McKinley's presidency, and the man identified by later commentators as the Wizard of the Gold Ounce. Hanna told McKinley that his chief duty in office was just to stay alive, to save the country from that madman Roosevelt. But in 1901, McKinley failed in that endeavor. He was the third president to be assassinated since the Civil War. Although no conspiracy was proved, suspicious commentators noted that the elimination of the protectionist McKinley was highly convenient for the pro-British interests. The door had been opened to an Anglo-American alliance backed by powerful financiers on both sides of the Atlantic, something that would not have happened in the 19th century, when England was still regarded by loyal Americans as the enemy. According to a historical treatise by Murray Rothbard, politics after McKinley became a struggle between two competing banking giants, the Morgans and the Rockefellers. The parties have sometimes changed hands, but the puppeteers pulling the strings have always been one of these two big money players. No popular third party candidate has had a real chance of winning because the bankers, who have the exclusive power to create the national money supply, hold all the trump cards. Teddy Roosevelt called himself a trust buster, but while the antitrust laws were on the books, little harm came to the powerful corporate monopolies called trusts during his administration. The trusts and cartels remained the puppeteers with real power, pulling the strings of puppet politicians who were basically bribed to stand back and do nothing, while the powerful conglomerates the antitrust laws were designed to regulate manipulated the laws. Roosevelt complained in 1906, quote, "Behind the ostensible government sits enthroned an invisible government, owing no allegiance and acknowledging no responsibility to the people. To destroy this invisible government, to befoul the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmanship of the day, end quote. So let's move on to the next chapter of The Web of Debt in continuance of this theme, Talking Heads and Invisible Hands, the Secret Government. And it starts with a quote from The Wonderful Wizard of Oz in the chapter called The Discovery of Oz the Terrible. And it goes, "But I don't understand," said Dorothy in bewilderment. "How was it that you appeared to me as a great head?" "That was one of my tricks," Oz answered. He pointed to a corner in which lay the great head, made out of many thicknesses of paper and with a carefully painted face. "This I hung from the ceiling by a wire," said Oz. "I stood behind the screen and pulled a thread to make the eyes move and the mouth open." Of course, this is the book version and not the movie version, but the main principle is the puppeteer concept. The idea of an invisible hand controlling the market was first advanced by Scottish economist Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations in 1776. But Smith's invisible hand was a benign one, a sort of mystical force that would make everything come out right if the market were just left alone. The invisible hand alluded to by later commentators was of a more insidious sort, a hand that wrote the pages of history with its own secret agenda. President Woodrow Wilson, who signed the Federal Reserve Act into law in 1913, said, quote, "We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled governments in the civilized world, no longer a government of free opinion, no longer a government by a vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men," end quote. Who were these dominant men? Wilson continued, saying, "Some of the biggest men in the United States in the field of commerce and manufacture are afraid of something. They know that there is a power somewhere so organized, so subtle, so watchful, so interlocked, so complete, so pervasive, that they had better not speak above their breath when they speak in condemnation of it." End of quote. Other leaders hinted that the government was controlled by invisible puppeteers. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's distant cousin, acknowledged in 1933, quote, "The real truth of the matter is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the large centers has owned the government since the days of Andrew Jackson. The country is going through a repetition of Jackson's fight with the Bank of the United States, only on a far bigger and broader basis." End quote. Felix Frankfurter, Justice of the Supreme Court, said in 1952, "The real rulers in Washington are invisible and exercise power from behind the scenes." End quote. And Congressman Wright Patman, chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, said in a speech on the House floor in 1967, quote, "In the U.S. today, we have in effect two governments. We have the duly constituted government, then we have an independent, uncontrolled, and uncoordinated government in the Federal Reserve, operating the money powers which are reserved to Congress by the Constitution." 2 decades later, at the conclusion of the Iran-Contra hearings, it was said, "There exists a shadowy government with its own air force, its own navy, its own fundraising mechanism, and the ability to pursue its own ideas of national interest, free from all checks and balances, and free from the law itself." If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. In 1927, Mayor John Hyland of New York compared the invisible government to a giant octopus, recalling the hydra-headed monster battled by Andrew Jackson. In a speech in the New York Times, Hyland said, quote, "The warning of Theodore Roosevelt has much timeliness today, for the real menace of our republic is this invisible government, which like a giant octopus sprawls its slimy length over city, state, and nation. It seizes in its long and powerful tentacles our executive officers, our legislative bodies, our schools, our courts, our newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection. At the head of this octopus are the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests and a small group of powerful banking houses, generally referred to as the international bankers. The little coterie of powerful international bankers virtually run the United States government for their own selfish purposes. They practically control both parties, write political platforms, make cat's paws of party leaders, use the leading men of private organizations, and resort to every device to place in nomination for high public office only such candidates as will be amenable to the dictates of corrupt big business. These international bankers and Rockefeller Standard Oil interests control the majority of the newspapers and magazines in this country. They use the columns of these papers to club into submission or drive out of office public officials who refuse to do the bidding of the powerful corrupt cliques which compose the invisible government. That's the end of the quote. In 1934, these international bankers and businessmen were labeled the robber barons by Matthew Josephson in a popular book of the same name. The robber barons were an unscrupulous lot who lived for market conquest and plotted takeovers like military strategy. John D. Rockefeller's father was called a snake oil salesman, flim-flam man, bigamist, and marginal criminal, never convicted but often accused of crimes ranging from horse theft to rape. He once boasted, "I cheat my boys every chance I get. I want to make them sharp." Once the robber barons had established a monopoly, they would raise prices, drop the quality of service, and engage in unfair trading practices to drive other firms out of business. The abuses of these monopolies became such a national scandal that in 1890, the Sherman Antitrust Act passed both houses of Congress with only one dissenting vote. The problem was enforcing it. In 1888, the entire Commonwealth of Massachusetts had receipts of only $7 million to oversee a Boston Railroad monopoly with gross receipts of $40 million. Well, that leads to the question, can you trust a trust? Well, what are trusts? Trusts are concentrations of wealth in the hands of a few in this context. The name came from the private banks entrusted with the money of depositors. Paper banknotes were called fiduciary money after the Latin word fide, meaning to trust, because the bankers had to be trusted to keep a sum of gold on hand to redeem their paper receipts on demand. These fiduciary banks played a key role in forming the giant trusts of the Gilded Age. The trusts had their own private banks, which were authorized to create and lend money at will. Like in the board game Monopoly, they used this paper money to buy up competitors and monopolize the game. Monopoly growth and abuse were at their height in the Gilded Age, the country's greatest period of laissez-faire. The trusts were so powerful that the trend toward monopolizing industry actually worsened after the Sherman Act was passed, and that's the Antitrust Act. Before 1898, there was an average of 46 major industrial mergers a year. After 1898, the number soared to 531 a year. By 1904, the top 4% of American businesses produced 57% of America's total industrial production, with a single firm dominating at least 60% of the production in 50 different industries. Ironically, the trusts became the strongest advocates of federal regulation since their monopoly power depended on the exclusive rights granted them by the government. By planting their own agents in the federal commissions, however, they used government regulation to gain greater control over industry, protect themselves from competition, and maintain high prices. Historically, there were many robber barons, but J. Pierpont Morgan, Andrew Carnegie, and John D. Rockefeller led the pack. Morgan dominated finance, Carnegie dominated steel, and Rockefeller monopolized oil. Carnegie built his business himself, and he loved competition. But Morgan was a different type of capitalist. He didn't build, he bought. He took over other people's businesses, and he hated competition. In 1901, Morgan formed the first billion-dollar corporation, U.S. Steel, out of mills he purchased from Carnegie. Rockefeller, too, dealt with competitors by buying them out. His company, Standard Oil, became the greatest of all monopolies and the first major multinational corporation. Before World War I, the financial and business structure of the United States was dominated by Morgan's finance and transportation companies and Rockefeller's Standard Oil. And these conglomerates had close alliances with each other. Through interlocking directorships, they were said to dominate almost the entire economic fabric of the United States. Other industrialists, seeing the phenomenal success of the Morgan and Rockefeller trusts, dreamt of buying out their competition and forming huge monopolies in the same way. But with the exception of Carnegie, no other capitalists had the money for these predatory practices. Aspiring empire builders were therefore drawn to Morgan and the other Wall Street bankers in search of funding. Corporations began drifting to New York to be near the big investment houses. In 1895, New York had become the headquarters for America's major corporations and the home of half its millionaires. Morgan's Bank at 23 Wall Street, known as the House of Morgan, was for decades the most important address in American finance. In 1920, a bomb exploded in front of the bank, killing 40 and injuring 400. Later, the nexus of American finance moved to the World Trade Center, which, of course, is the chosen target for another tragic attack in 2001. Early in the 20th century, Morgan controlled a Wall Street syndicate that financial writer John Moody called the greatest financial power in the history of the world. Morgan dominated 100 corporations with more than $22 billion in assets. And this is at the beginning of the 20th century. In 1913, in a book called Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis wrote that the greatest threat to the American economy was the money trust. According to the Wall Street Journal, the money trust was just another name for J. Pierpont Morgan, who had founded the world's most powerful bank. Like the Rothschild in England, Morgan had extraordinary political influence in the United States. Morgan men routinely represented the U.S. government at international monetary meetings, something they continue to do today. Alan Greenspan, longstanding chairman of the Federal Reserve, was a corporate director for J.P. Morgan before President Ronald Reagan appointed him to that post. Those fortunate corporations, favored with funding from Morgan and the other Wall Street bankers, were able to monopolize their industries. But where did the Wall Street bankers get the money to underwrite all these mergers and acquisitions? Central question. The answer was revealed by Congressman Wright Patman and other close observers. The robber barons were pulling money out of an empty hat. Their privately owned banks held the ultimate credit card, a bottomless source of accounting entry money that could be lent to their affiliated corporate mistresses. The funds could then be used to buy out competitors, corner the market in scarce raw materials, and make political donations, lobby Congress, and control public opinion. And I will continue next show with an investigation into who pulled the strings of the robber barons. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.